Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. And the first question today is, why is Paris uncovering a river it buried a century ago? In 1899, a writer for the French newspaper Le Figaro surveyed the damage Parisians had done to the Bièvre River. For centuries, the 13-foot-wide river had snaked up through southern Paris, joining the Seine in the city center. But as the Industrial Revolution took off, tanneries and dyers had severely polluted its waters. It flows slowly, oily, and black, a writer at the time noted, streaked with acids and dotted with soapy and putrid pustules. Not very pleasant. Well, authorities opted to close the river, and they sealed it up at the last section in 1912. Its waters no longer even run under Paris, having been cut off at towns closer to its source, about 13 miles or so southwest of the city. Today, though, the Bièvre has an unlikely ally, climate change. The same industrial activity that destroyed the river has helped drive global warming, with Paris' average temperature already over 4 degrees Fahrenheit higher than in the pre-industrial era. The urban heat island effect, in which buildings and pavements absorb more heat than vegetation and water do, is making matters worse, and it's driving the temperature of Paris up by as much as 14 degrees Fahrenheit, more than rural areas during heat waves. By the mid-21st century, according to the local government estimates, Paris could have a climate that resembled that of Sevilla in southern Spain. We have to adapt Paris to the future, and yet this is one of the most densely populated cities in the world, with lots of heritage restrictions. So we are left limited in what we can do. That, according to the deputy mayor of Paris. La Bièvre is one of the great tools that Paris has. Bodies of water help to cool their surrounding areas because as water particles absorb heat from the air and then evaporate, they carry the heat away with them, thereby lowering the ground level temperature. They can also mitigate floods by giving excess rainwater somewhere to go, and they can make cities a more pleasant place to live. Well, with that in mind, the mayor of Paris, Mayor Anne Hidalgo, agreed to a proposal for the rebirth of the Bièvre by the Paris Green Party as part of a 2021 coalition deal. A feasibility study is underway, and it's expected to be completed, at least the first Parisian section, by 2026, at a cost of around $16 million. It will join several stretches of the river recently uncovered in smaller towns to the south. These, the Bièvre's waters, will begin running in through pipes under Paris to reach the Seine once more. The Bièvre isn't the only urban river to get a new chance at life in this climate change era. Last May, Manchester in the United Kingdom uncovered a downtown section of the River Medlock, which it had buried 50 years ago. Authorities in New York City are setting a $130 million plan to reopen the Bronx Tibbetts Brook to reduce flood risks. Well, this trend represents a reversal among urban leaders who once saw limiting nature's footprint as crucial to development. And now, gradually, cities are learning to live with nature. I am back again, and this time it's humidity, methane, and orcas. Interesting grouping, huh? Well, rising humidity levels have been caused by climate change, and they are accelerating the rise of extreme heat and stronger tornadoes, hurricanes, and even floods. This, according to the journal Axios. Until now, climate change has been measured purely in terms of temperature. But a team of researchers in China and in the United States say that this approach overlooks another crucial driver, and that's moisture. They found that using a metric, combining the two, that air moisture and atmospheric energy are rising even faster than temperatures, and that these increases are strongly correlated to extreme heat and precipitation. You see, as the air warms, it holds more moisture, and when the moisture condenses, it releases energy. That energy fuels stronger storms and more intense downpours. The finding explains why extreme weather is increasingly so much worse in the tropics, even though temperatures aren't rising as quickly as elsewhere. Since 1980, the surface temperature of the world has warmed almost a degree centigrade, or almost a degree and a half Fahrenheit. But if you include energy from humidity, as this new calculation does, it has warmed 1.5 degrees centigrade and over 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit. And as much as 4 degrees centigrade and 7 degrees Fahrenheit in the tropics. By 2100, we could see a 60% increase in extreme rainfall, and extreme heat events could be up to 30 times more frequent than they are now. It is the humidity increase accompanied by warming, which makes climate change into a climate crisis. And now, while we're talking about the atmosphere, let's look at methane gas and its contribution. Gas stoves leak significant amounts of methane, even when they're turned off, according to a new study. Researchers from Stanford University measured emissions of the greenhouse gas from ovens and broilers in homes in California. They found that as much as 1.3% of the gas that the appliance use leaks into the atmosphere. Some methane escapes during the brief seconds before the pilot light kicks in. Stoves with automatic sparkers were slightly faster, and some during cooking. But about 80% of the leakage takes place when stoves are off, presumably because of loose couplings and fittings on the pipes. Simply owning a natural gas stove and having natural gas pipes and fittings in your home leads to more emissions over a 24-hour period than the amount emitted while the burners are on. While methane doesn't linger in the atmosphere as long as carbon dioxide, it is a more potent greenhouse gas. The researchers estimate that the leaks from the roughly 40 million gas stoves in the U.S. have the same planet warming effect as the emission, I pause before saying this, from 500,000 gas-powered cars. Just a slight pause until we go to the oceans, where orcas are beginning to kill blue whales. Packs of orcas hunt and make meals of the largest species on Earth, the blue whale. Scientists have now confirmed this. The orca, known as killer whales, despite belonging to the same family as dolphins, have been seen preying on other whale species, but never on the largest of them. And in a newly published paper, researchers report that they witnessed a dozen orcas attacking a blue whale in the seas off of southwestern Australia. The attack was a savage hour-long ordeal, and the predators bit off the victim's dorsal fin so it couldn't escape, and then chewed off hunks of flesh. When the blue whale was dead, about 50 other orcas arrived to feast on the massive carcass. One of the researchers said, "We were astounded at what we were seeing. We didn't expect this." And since then, there have been more orca attacks on blue whales. Is it correct to say dinner is served? Well, here we are, almost at the end of winter, we hope. I'd like to talk to you about seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, as it is referred to. And this is from the Consumer Report publication on health, the February issue. The days are short and cold, and many of us are experiencing dips in mood. This is often due to the effects of winter's reduced hours of sunlight on our internal clock. Sunlight helps regulate serotonin, helping to set mood, and melatonin, which is key for a normal sleep-wake cycle. When these are thrown off, it can affect both mood and sleep. And for about 5% of the adults, in the United States, the disruption is significant enough to cause seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. This form of depression usually appears in late fall, but it tends to be most severe in January and this month, in February. SAD symptoms may be similar to those of other types of depression. They include feeling down most of the day, having little interest in activities you usually enjoy, a weight gain of about 5% within a month or so, sleeping too much, slowed movements or speech, fatigue, feelings of guilt or worthlessness, trouble concentrating or thinking, and unfortunately, thoughts of death or suicide. Typically, a doctor will diagnose SAD if you have five or more of these symptoms. The first line therapy for SAD is usually a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, as it's called, which is an antidepressant, or a bupropion, along with light therapy. Light therapy users should sit in front of a box that emits a very bright light. In this kind of therapy, but before you use light therapy, the light therapy boxes are available over the counter, but you don't want to treat yourself without a doctor's diagnosis. Since some conditions, it can mimic depression, like bipolar disorder, can actually be worsened by these treatments for SAD. So I just bring up this topic briefly, draw your attention to it. You may like to look at, as I say, it's a Consumer Report on Health publication for February. Some good information there for us all. And then some easy ways to eat less sodium. There isn't time in today's program to talk about this at length, but I can at least tell you the ways that you can consider reducing sodium. First of all, take a tally. Write down how much sodium you're getting from foods throughout the day. That'll suggest to you the top culprits, and you can choose then where to cut back. Also, you can train your taste buds. People typically don't notice small reductions, say 10% in sodium. So use a little less salt on every meal and gradually lower the amount more and more over time. Then you should upgrade your salt if you use it. How ounce for ounce table kosher and sea salt have about the same sodium count, but the last two have larger crystals that take up more volume on a measuring spoon. So they'd be a good choice, the kosher salt and the sea salt. Or you can swap in some salt substitutes, products that add either saltiness or enough of a savory flavor called umami, so you don't miss the salt. Or you can skip salt as you cook. Salt gets incorporated into food, which means that you may not taste it much in the final product. Instead, sprinkle it on right before serving. And when you add it at the end, the crystals will rest on top of the food. And then you can perk up your food with spices and herbs and aromatics. That'll give the food a little zest and Perhaps you won't miss Phelps quite so much. And then you can spot hidden sodium resources. Because remember, manufacturers add sodium to food you might not expect it to be in order to enhance flavors and textures and to act as a preservative. So check out those processed foods and packaged foods because they can really add up throughout the day. And then finally, you can decode claims. And by that, I mean the words light and sodium means that a product is at least 50% less than its original or competing one, while reduced sodium means it has at least 25% less. So maybe these tips will be of help to you. I hope so. And then for now, we'll step away just for a moment or two, and you can listen to the music. You probably know that the future of work is here. Now is the moment to rethink the office. Rest up while you can. We're on the precipice of what's likely one of the most important chapters for work in our lifetimes as we start resuming normal activities. This means we can expect this spring to shift back to offices on a broad scale, to resume business travel, to reacquaint with colleagues or meet them for the first time, to adjust our family rhythms to the shift in demands from work. Opportunities to reshape culture and norms are rare. And the question hanging over us all is, what will the new norm look like? We know what workers want. They want more flexibility when and where they work. That most workplaces have much further to go to be truly diverse and inclusive. We know that offices need better ventilation and reconfiguring for colleagues and to connect so that there's better collegiality at the workplace. And not just solo work I'm talking about. We know caregivers need extra support. And we know that there's an ongoing mental health crisis that employers haven't adequately addressed. With those facts as our starting point, we have a unique opportunity right now to redefine the future of work. And now we must look on to the future, my friends, because we're getting down to the end of today's show. Very pleased that you tuned in to 101.5, because here in this station, we work very hard to entertain, to inform you, and once in a while, to amuse you. Someone asked me the other day, I've read that Tai Chi is relaxing. Can I learn it at home? Yes. There is a book entitled The Complete Idiot's Guide to Tai Chi and Shi Gong Illustrated. Alpha Books. 2012 is the publication date. And you can find certified instructors at American TaiChi.org. If you fail or have balance problems, check with your doctor first. And so, I want you to stay healthy. Be careful out there. Be kind to each other. You're going to surprise a lot of people when you do that. And it's been a pleasure giving you the information of today, all the way from the Hidden River down to the end item, the one that I just completed. And so I'm going to bid you adieu, but not for long. We'll be back soon. And we're going to be talking about such interesting topics as how is the hydromatic gear shifting drive operated? When was it innovated and invented and put into cars? We're also going to talk about Albert Kahn, the architect who created much of the landscape of Detroit and its tall buildings clustered downtown and midway out on Woodward Avenue. And so that's about it for today, my friends. Willie and I, that's Willie Nelson, you remember, he and I are going to go down the road again looking for items that are appropriate for a little of this, a little of that. And as Willie would say, y'all come back now, you hear? Bye-bye.